Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. I'm David Todd. It's Season 8, Episode 35. It's Bengals Week, and the Steelers are 4-2, Dave, and we got lots to talk about. And our buddy Paul Denner Jr. will be joining us from Bengals.com as we have a beat writer. He'll be up with us the last 15 or 20 minutes of the program. So should be a fun show. We got a lot to get to. Should we kick things off with the injury report? Because the Steelers have been running kind of scot-free on injuries more or less, with, you know, the aside from the Gilbert and Foster situation, but maybe piling up a little bit this week.
Yeah, it's Bengals week. Is your mind right, David?
My mind is right for this one, Saturday. By the way, for everybody who's going to the game Sunday, if you just remind you early on here, it's been flexed. I don't remember them flexing games this early in the season, but they have moved it to 4:25, and the Steelers will play very few 1 o'clock games from here on in. As you know, the second half of the season is loaded with prime time, and so this one got moved as well.
Yeah, my mind's right. I'm acting accordingly this week, and it's always a lot more funner to go through the tape after a win than it is after a loss there. So yeah, we'll start off with some injury notes here. As you said, Mike Tomlin met the media as usual on Tuesday. Marcus Gilbert, after re-injuring that hamstring kind of early in that game against the Chiefs. Tomlin said he's down there getting treatment right now on Tuesday. He doesn't know what the week holds for him.
I'll tell you what the week holds is Marcus Gilbert not playing this week, and I would think not playing. You're going to see Marcus Gilbert. We're going to start over again with this hamstring. I mean, what was it, Dave? Did he miss the game he came out of plus two more?
Plus three more.
So, you know, look, pencil Marcus Gilbert in for what's today. I mean, I don't know the Packers game.
After the bye, at least. You got two games.
Yeah, right. Two games, the bye week, and then the Packers. I mean, you know, maybe the – yeah.
What do you think about holding them out for that Colts game after the bye week as well?
Yeah, look, you see where things are. And you know, this is the age-old question, and my answer to this is always the same, and we get asked every year, every week. It's, you know, well, maybe you let them sit an extra week. The deal is, look, when guys are cleared by the medical staff, they think they're able to play without injuring themselves. Hamstrings are the most muscle pulls are the most difficult thing to kind of ascertain that stuff. I mean, you can watch a bone heal. You can physically see it on an X-ray. With MRIs, you can learn some other stuff. But MRIs can't even really get into the deep muscle tissue and understand exactly what strength level you're at. But they go through all this testing, and they understand what it requires to play football. When they put a guy back on the field, you know, and obviously alignment, the responsibility, you know, the hamstring role of alignment is very different than if it's Antonio Brown or Martavis Bryant. Your energy and pushing off and doing a lot of strength work as opposed to running, you know, 20-yard sprints or stopping and starting and cutting the way they are. But, it didn't work. So they're wrong with him. And typically when you have a setback like this where a guy leaves a game, the length of time that he was out, you can probably use that as a baseline for when he'll be back.
And the Steelers signed Jake Rogers back to the practice squad on Wednesday morning. So if you needed any other kind of sign that Marcus Gilbert's probably not going to practice this week or maybe even next week moving forward, it's that. So I would expect Chris Hubbard to start at right tackle again against the Chiefs. It sounds like, according to Tomlin, that Ramon Foster, who missed the game against the Chiefs with a back injury of some description, Tomlin's optimistic that he'll be back for Sunday's game against the Bengals. So if that's the case, then B.J. Finney will go back to the sideline and probably serve as your extra tackle once again as well, too. So, you know, not brutal. You obviously would like Gilbert in there over Hubbard, but Hubbard, I guess, could be characterized as serviceable. I think he's done nice things in the run game. David, talking about Hubbard, obviously, you know, deficient a little bit in the pass protection game, but, you know, not overly bad. So we hope that Foster gets back. A couple of inside linebacker injuries that bear watching this week. Vince Williams, who left in that game, I think right there at the beginning of the fourth quarter. You know, he was on crutches after the game, but shortly afterwards he said on Twitter that, you know, he'll be fine, whatever that means. But we'll see what happens with him this week in practice. And Tyler Matakevich, who replaced Vince Williams in that game and I think finished, was noted as having a shoulder injury. You know, Tomlin says he's optimistic about Vince Williams, and then, you know, we'll see what happens going forward with Tyler Matakevich as well. They'll get clarity in the week, later in the week, on those two guys. An interesting note, Tomlin was asked on Tuesday if he has confidence in LJ Fort playing. Should the need arise, this, of course, assumes that both Vince Williams and Tyler Matakevich will not be able to play against the Bengals. Tomlin, you know, gave the expected response, yes, he is. Fort, who's probably best suited to play the Mac role instead of the Buck role, has, I think, done both. And Tomlin says not a concern to him having to switch positions if that happens. He was also asked about Arthur Motes potentially serving as a break glass in case of emergency inside linebacker. Tomlin, you know, said, yeah, that's possible. He doesn't see it getting to that that stage. But here's one interesting note. On Monday, the Steelers signed Jordan Dangerfield back to the practice squad. And, yes, he's not a linebacker, but Jordan Dangerfield does play on special teams, so that will help cover you, you know, should one or both of Vince Williams and Tyler Matakevich not be able to play. And Dangerfield does some of his best work down in the box as well. So I think, we'll see what happens. You know, Kelsey is the only other inside linebacker you have on your practice squad. I can't see him being promoted on Saturday with his short resume. So look for Saturday will be a good sign. If Jordan Dangerfield is promoted from the practice squad, then obviously you'd have to make a corresponding move. We can discuss that minutia if you want, but that would be a good sign.
Let me ask you this on Dangerfield. I have been surprised. Now, look, I know he was waived injured and then waived, and that, you know, the deal is you can't immediately sign guys. But Jordan Dangerfield, he was a street free agent here. They could have signed him before this week, right?
I think it depends on the stipulation of how many weeks he's paid for with that injury settlement.
Okay. So I don't know. I didn't know the answer. I got asked a couple times on Twitter to the minutia of this situation. I would have thought the Steelers, particularly when they had some issues at safety a few weeks back, if they could have signed him, they would have signed him. They didn't. So maybe this is the first time he's been available. I'm not surprised. You know, look, they waived the safety to sign him. So I don't know, you know, I would be surprised if they expect Jordan Dangerfield to play down in the box. But I do think this gives you, if you want to, look, you're going to play a team like the Bengals where the Bengals are going to look to run the football here. And we'll get into our buddy Paul Denner Jr. here coming up in a bit. But, you know, they've got Joe Mixon. Everybody knows the situation with their running game and Gio, what they do out of the backfield. So, you know, this is a game. I don't know. Will the Steelers be in base 40% of the time? Will they be in, you know, base 3-4, 25-30% of the time? That'll be interesting. The game score obviously will dictate some of that. But it will be interesting to see, you know, Matakevich. You would think if Matakevich's shoulder and arm is not, if it's actually attached, that he will do everything in his power to play because he's never had an opportunity to start an NFL game. So this would be an opportunity for him. And then, of course, Mike gets asked about LJ Fort, and I'm particularly high on LJ Fort. I know Dave feels comfortable with LJ Fort as well. I've always thought, you know, just from watching the play, that LJ Fort's a little bit more of a dynamic linebacker than Tyler Matakevich. Matakevich is certainly a willing and capable tackler and a guy who's going to be in the right spot at the right time. So interesting that he got the first shot when Vince went down in that game. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. I'll be surprised if – well, you know, I don't know what you do if L.J. Ford and Ryan Shazier are your only two inside linebackers. You have to have a backup plan to that. And I don't know if that means – you know, Arthur Motes gets reps this week on the inside or what it means exactly. But they have to – today's practice will be indicative of who gets to run there with the second team inside linebackers, because if those two guys aren't going to practice today for sure, I would assume. And so that'll tell us something, who gets to run in those spots.
Here's the answer to your question. Teams are not able to re-sign waived injured players until the injury settlement time period plus three additional weeks have passed.
Okay, so that means it really could have been, and maybe the fact that it was a Tuesday signing and announced on Tuesday tells you something, that the Steelers wanted to get there, or maybe a Monday signing, that the Steelers wanted to get that done ASAP, as soon as, you know, obviously as soon as possible. So we never get the answer on how many weeks that settlement was, so. Interesting to see that.
Yeah.
Okay, good stuff. Good stuff on all of that. Any other bumps and bruises that were mentioned in particular?
No, he just said that there were other players that had, you know, left the game and went back in. You know, I don't want to say that there's not, because we get a surprise on a Wednesday with X player not practicing or something like that. We'll be sure to be asked about that. But on the surface, Gilbert seems to be the most serious. And then, of course, Williams and Tyler Matakevich. Mike sounds confident. Optimistic about at least one of those two players being healthy. And once again, it's not guaranteed that if Dangerfield was promoted, it would be because both those players probably aren't playing. And Matakevich is such a big factor on special teams. And obviously, if Matakevich is not on special teams, you're probably going to need L.J. Fort. Playing, if both those guys are down, L.J. Fort would obviously have to get some reps at starter, and how much special teams work would you want him to have at that point? It's just something to watch, and it was a bit unusual that they signed Dangerfield on a Monday, but it does make sense because of the time elapsed period there, why that didn't happen. And in addition, they swapped a safety for a safety on the practice squad in addition.
It's going to be an ugly bow, but let's try to put a bow on this Martavis Bryant thing before we get back into the game with the Chiefs and move forward to the Bengals. My take on all of this was the way it came out was awkward. It obviously was leaked by Martavis Bryant's agent to Ian Rappaport and to everybody else who would make a phone call to the agent. He affirmed it to anybody who wanted to call, and that's how it gets confirmed. So I think Dan Graziano was the second guy, and then you just go through the list of the local guys of Caboli and Ed Bouchette, and you know, seemingly 50 people confirmed the story. So the agent's willing to say that some point along the way, somebody requested a trade. Now, Martavis Bryant clearly in the team media scrums that happened on Monday or Tuesday clearly wanted to deflect all attention away from this. And so they said, yeah, he wants to be traded to the Warriors because the NBA season is opening up and he's a big, tall guy. And so they made a joke about the whole thing. I got no problem with that. Look, maybe Martavis Bryant said that and maybe he's embarrassed it got out. Maybe he said it and maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe he didn't kind of realize the ramifications of saying that. In frustration, he talked to his agent one night and told his agent to ask for a trade, but, you know, hadn't thought through any of it. Any of these things are possible, even likely scenarios. The important thing, in my opinion, is one, is it's not going to happen. There's zero chance that Martavis Bryant's getting traded. Zero, none, zero at this trade deadline that's 2 weeks away from today. And two is he doesn't seem like a malcontent, discontent in the locker room. Now, maybe every guy on the team's covering for him, but that's not typically the way. Ben stood up for him when he spoke Tuesday. Martavis, you know, didn't seem to be unhappy in the way he's reacted to things. And as I said on this is going to get to one of our listeners' emails. As I pointed on Monday and Sunday night on Twitter, a guy asking for the ball more and wanting to be more integrated in the offense is not a newsflash. It's every guy ever. And Mike reiterated the same thing yesterday. He said, I understand. I don't need to ask guys, you know, do they want to be more involved? Do they want to play more? Do they need to want to know, you know, more of this and more of that? He said, I just take that as a given. So that's the situation. This is a non-event, but what these guys are very good at, and you see Jason Lacamfora do it every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, and you see these other guys do it at 7:30 on Sundays, is they know they can pop something into the news stream that when everybody's paying attention, that'll get national coverage and blow it up, and that's exactly what happened. But again, I think it's a complete non-factor.
Yeah, if his agent, which I believe is still Tom Santinello, did that, I don't know what he looks to gain from that. Look, Martavis and Ben hit this on the head, I think, in his radio interview on Tuesday. There were no signs of a frustrated Martavis Bryant, in my opinion, on the field against the Chiefs. He was probably some of his best blocking ever, maybe in that game. Sure, he didn't get the pass target set that he probably wanted and hasn't for the season, but he's had some opportunities to make some deep catches and all. It's going to come at some point. Now, I've said this for a while, I think, and I try to reiterate it on Twitter after this report broke the other night. Martavis Bryant's not getting another contract with the Steelers. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I wouldn't put it at zero, but I wouldn't put it greater than, 10-15%. So the answer is that yes, I would agree with that.
And his contract toiled after the suspension and all, so he's under contract through 2018. Now the trade deadline is a little less now than 2 weeks away. So if you're going to trade him, it would have to be in 2 weeks. That's not going to happen. The best case scenario of a trade with Martavis Bryant, you still would have to wonder if teams would be willing to do it, is during the offseason. And even so, such a deal probably wouldn't come until after the draft. And would teams trade for a essential one-year rental, what could be a one-year rental on top of it? So none of this adds up whatsoever. And if they were to trade them, and I obviously don't think they will, it would have to happen within in the next 2 weeks. And hopefully this will all blow over as quick as it popped up there. I think Ben will talk to the media on Wednesday and probably other players as well too. They'll finally try to put it behind them, all today, and then move on. And then we'll sit and wait and see what drama we're talking about next week.
Okay, so we can get into some of the game. And I think one of the things that we talked about coming out of this game was the performance of Ben. And what do we think of Ben's performance? And that it wasn't perfect, but it was better than maybe his best game, some of the more recent games. But you get a chance to watch the All-22, and one of the great things that, I'm sure most of our 98% of our listeners don't pay the money for the All-22, and I understand that. And the reason why is they can listen to you and I and watch the great work that you and Alex and everybody else does, Matthew, putting up the gifts of some of these plays. And we talked about two plays specifically, and the one I had asked you about on the Monday podcast was, if you remembered the third and two play where Ben looked right to AB, he's covered, and then he comes back all the way across the field to Antonio to Le'Veon Bell, and hasn't matched up with the linebacker, but it's a difficult throw to the sideline over a linebacker, and it ends up being incomplete. It's late in the game, and the Steelers have to punt. And I knew there was a drag route over the middle, and I was pretty sure it was Juju. And it's difficult to tell on the replay, having watched it a bunch of times before the All-22, if Ben has the lane to throw there. And you put it up perfectly, and it's wide open.
It sure is, isn't it? That's college wide open right there. I hope I hope he's asked about that today. I mean, he's asked some great questions, I think, during his Tuesday interview, and unfortunately, with his Wednesday, what they call Ben's Day, with the local media there in the locker room, unfortunately, ends up being a lot of follow up questions to things that were already asked on Tuesday. But you know, I'd be interested to see what he saw or didn't see, on that play. Was it just too quick of him trying to come off the first read to his right? But it looks like his read's right to left on that play. Jesse James had cleared out space running a vertical on that play, and Juju flashes right in front of him, right in the middle of the field. And that's an easy, easy pitch and catch, I think, in my opinion, for a first down, and you move the sticks in that situation there. Like we said, he only had 8 incompletions in that game. One was a throwaway, which we're going to talk about that one in a minute. Another one was an interception. Another one was the play that we're talking about now, the incomplete pass pass to Bell. One was another incomplete pass to Bell in the end zone on a play that Ben admits that he had changed there in the red zone as well too. So statistically, you look at his numbers and you say, okay, 17 of 25, 252 yards, a touchdown, and an interception, which you can put on the wide receiver. But it could have been so much better starting with completing that, had he hit Juju there over the middle.
Yeah, you got so. I mean, that's just.
You realize we're gonna catch a lot more flack. Beep, beep.
No, I mean, this is just the truth. I mean, this is, hashtag truth. I mean,
it's what we do. I mean, this is what we're supposed to do, right? I mean,
yeah. And the thing is, obviously, is he so locked in on these two guys that nobody else is, first or second read. I mean, he has to. He's coming. So the thing about reading defenses, and I think people who follow the game know this, is look, you progress through the reads, and you read from deep to short. And if you're reading right to left, you read right to left. You don't read far right, far left, and come back to the middle unless you time affords you. You read across, and you should be reading the middle as you're going across to the left. And Ben obviously doesn't do that. He reads right, and then he reads directly left. He doesn't look at Juju coming across the middle. So look, the thing about all of this stuff is every quarterback in the game is going to miss reads and miss plays. So, we're picking on specific plays, and that's, this, we could do this in every game for every quarterback. We could do it for Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, and we could do it for DeShone Kizer. Obviously, with DeShone Kizer, you're going to do it a lot more than you do it for Brady and Rodgers. The point is, these were significant plays in the game that the Steelers were in a position where, the Chiefs were in a position to win this game late, and they never should have been. And these are the plays that are the difference between winning the game comfortably, where statistically and physically and in every kind of component through 45 minutes, the Steelers completely dominated the Chiefs, and being in a game where at the very end you might lose. If Ben completes the pass here to Juju, that's a first down. You're moving into Chiefs territory. Maybe you put more points on the board. The clock certainly continues to run, or you're at the 4-minute mark, and you're going to grind out at least 2 more minutes or timeouts of the Chiefs. I mean, everything is to your advantage if you're successful on that play. And then, Dave, let's backtrack to the other play, and you caught this one, and I didn't see this, and this was not obvious watching the game film. You had to see it on the All-22. So why don't you describe what happened? And this goes to a play that was very controversial at the time because of what the Steelers chose to do, going shotgun empty. They didn't go empty. They went sidecar with Le'Veon Bell. They went shotgun on first down from about the 2.5-yard line on their second drive, the 93-yard drive that set up the field goal.
Yeah, and real quick to reiterate what happened on that missed Juju play. That was a 3rd-and-2 play, and that happened at the KC 35-yard line at that point. And if you hit that, you're obviously well within or you one would think that you're within field goal range for Boswell at that point. So what happened after that? They took the delay of game, and then Barry punted, and then fortunately, I think, luckily that didn't turn into points the other way there, but you could have tacked on at least another three, one would think there. Yeah, the other play that I came across came, you know, at the tail end of that long drive that they had, and it was on that throwaway play. He did have a sidecar on that play, and Martavis Bryant sits down right there, what, 2 yards deep in the end zone, and shows his numbers there. It looks like the blocking is adequate. It looks like there's a passing lane right there. Looks like the DB is 5 yards, just starting his break, forward there, or at an angle towards Bryant. But in my opinion, and Ben's got it corked. You know, got it cocked as well. I don't understand why he didn't pull the trigger there, and that's another play I'd like him asked about. And boy, what happens if you turn that? You know, if you connect there, in that situation instead of settling for 3 points and there. So those two plays specifically, both over the middle, are ones that. You know, I wonder what the film room, what the quarterback room was like when going over them on Monday.
Yeah, that is the question. Is like, does Ben say, look, I missed these. I see the reads now. I need to do a better job of coming across or what? The picture you have up, and again, you need to run this and you need to look at it. What you see there is you see, Martavis Bryant and a yard and a half into the end zone, square to the quarterback. It looks like Ben is looking dead at him with the ball up, in a position to quickly release the ball. And, from release to getting there, it certainly doesn't look like the defensive lineman who is off balance, leaning away from where the ball's coming from, is going to be able to get a hand up. So it's a clear throwing lane. And there's a safety coming from the right side of Martavis Bryant where Ben throws to the left shoulder. Just the distance that the ball is going to be thrown isn't going to take more than a second. And the guys, I can't see a situation where that ball doesn't get to Martavis Bryant uninhibited. And so you look at it, and again, it's nitpicking stuff in the film room. It's like, talking about a guy, taking a pitch on the outside corner. What did he see when he was seeing the pitch, and where do you think it was going to go? You never quite, you can't put yourself in those shoes. So what did Ben see on these two reads or not see? But this one, the second one, the difference between not throwing to Juju is it looks like he looks right across Juju and never looks at the route. In this picture that is up on Steelers Depot and on Twitter that you can see, it looks like Ben is staring at him. And you can see that Le'Veon is to his right, and you wonder even before throwing it away why he doesn't think about just flipping it off to Le'Veon, which he ended up not doing. That was kind of an awkward dance they did there for about a second after this still shot. Ben does know that he starts to move to his right, and Le'Veon Bell's not quite sure what to do, whether to stay in and block for him or whether to release, and it's kind of an odd little dance they do before Ben throws the ball away. But Yeah. These are two plays that, and the reason we're pointing them out is they're game changing plays. They are game changing plays because the Steelers punted from that on that 35. That's the play where we talked about it should have been two down territory, and Mike should have gone for it, the first down because you can put them away and use more clock. They didn't. They punted into the end zone, but they got the break of the penalty of the Chiefs. Blah, blah, blah. You know how the game went. But they're just really significant moments in the game where Ben didn't see something that looked to be there and obvious.
Yeah, and someone posted back to me on Twitter saying something to the lines of, Monday morning quarterback or whatnot, That's what we're supposed to do, right?
Well, that's what they do in the film room. That's what happens after every game. That's what the team does. They go in and say, this is what you're supposed to do. This is what you did well. This is what you missed. This is what you didn't do well. That's the point of it.
We're not doing our job if we don't point these things out. Yes, look, the Steelers won, and as we said, Ben statistically played well, but it's little things like this that's not not allowed that and penalties and getting in too many third and longs and not connecting on the deep ball are things that are preventing this offense from you know, putting teams away kind of thing. So
exactly. Okay, so what did we miss from the game in terms of performance now that we've both had a chance to look at it more? I mean, again, Stephon Tuitt, I don't know if we made enough of how kind of dominant he's been on that D-line and how good that defense was in the first half. Artie Burns had a good, you know, a good early part of that game. I mean, he was god-awful and almost single-handedly cost them the game late. But he had a good start to that game with some pass breakups, maybe got there a little bit early on one of them. In the very beginning of the game, probably could have been called for pass interference. But anybody else on the defense? You know, we've talked about Mike Hilton's explosiveness and ability to time up his blitzes. Really effective. Obviously, did miss the tackle when Thomas when he got behind Burns. But very few mistakes from Mike Hilton that we've seen. What do you got?
Yeah, I think maybe one of the better games we've seen Sean Davis play as well too. Right? You know.
Yep.
Good game there. I thought Vince did some nice things. Boy, he just did those two sacks. I've got Jim's up there. He just ran Kareem Hunt right over. I mean, poor little kid thought he had a chance there. He trucked them both times on both those sacks, and that's the type of things that if you're gonna come, you better get there. And Vince Williams did on both those, and both against Kareem Hunt. I thought Vince, did some nice things the rest of the game there. Mike Hilton, as you said, boy, reading that screen over there to his side on that one and fighting through traffic. Ike Taylor said he's got what did he say? Little man syndrome or something like that. He doesn't know that he's only 5'9 or 5'10 or whatever he is. He plays really a lot bigger than that. Who else? James Harrison in his 15 snaps, obviously impacted the game. Tuitt's a beast, man, and so is Cam Hayward and really Javon Hart. When those three guys are on, they are on. The secondary, you nailed it on Artie Burns, a good, first three quarters there. Some breakdowns there in the second half as well. Really a complete defensive performance there overall, except for the last, X amount of drives, if you will. And offensively, what can you say about the offensive line? A really good on the move in this game. I thought Jesse's blocking was a little better as well. Vance McDonald, this offense continues to be able to move the football when Vance McDonald is on the field. That's a good sign. Roosevelt Nix, although he only played really early and late, did Roosevelt Nix type things in that game as well too. So then, obviously Le'Veon Bell has had one of those games where it looks like he was being controlled with a joystick at certain times.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with all that. Vance McDonald's blocking is really good. He's more mobile than Matt Spaeth. You can see why David Johnson maybe was less necessary. The way Vance McDonald has come in and blocked, it has been a revelation. And we mentioned it. Jesse has, we've talked about Jesse as a player in all facets of the game. He's a bit erratic. He can be a good pass catching tight end, but he's really had a case of the drops during his career. He is a willing blocker, but at times not a very effective blocker. But he was a good blocker in this game. So we'll see how the tandem of these two work, but neither of these guys, they talked about being the best 1-2 tandem in the league. Look, neither of these guys is, I think, in the top half of the tight ends in the league, because neither of them has an exceptional skill. But if there is one, it is Vance McDonald's blocking. It is really good.
Especially on the move. Especially on the move. Okay, shall we talk about Steelers Nation's favorite player, Mike Mitchell?
Oh, yeah, let's get to that, because this is interesting. And, I think we tried to outline this on Monday by just saying what it looked like happened on the tape initially. And that was, you know, you could see that there's a hand to his back from Chicolo. It's hard to see in the game film, you know, the broadcast film, you know, where everybody's feet are and whether, you know, where Mitchell's steps go. So Mike got asked about it. And Mike said, I saw what you saw, and said he got tripped. Mitchell, I thought, gave a, you know, relatively dispassionate, which is, I think, better, but an expressive defense, saying, here's what happened. You know, I got tripped up. I was going down. You can see I didn't even fall toward the quarterback, and Alex Smith is backing up into me. There's some, I think, you know, that plays out as true from what you see on the tape. Now, I think Matthew responded to something you said on Twitter and said something very important. Like, you pointed out accurately that Mike Mitchell's been fined twice, and does that make him a dirty player? Well, whether or not he's a dirty player, the perception is out there that he's a dirty player. And there is a perception, there is a belief amongst many, and I'll include myself in this group, that while I love any guy's enthusiasm on the field, there's a time and place for things. And it's hard for me to forget the hit where Mike Mitchell knocked out one of the Bengals receivers and stood over him a little bit, hit him in the ribs, didn't knock him out. I think it was Marvin Jones a couple of years ago at Heinz Field. Stood over him, then ran to the sideline. And the next play is third down, and he's running back trying to get in place to actually be in place position-wise for the next play, because he's come over to the sideline and flexed for the hit where, you know, he knocked the wind out of a guy. Things like that annoy the crap out of me. I know they annoy the crap out of Dave and a lot of our listeners. So there's that. You put all that there. But if people want to look at Mike Mitchell on tape for the 3 years he's been with the Steelers, a little bit of a rough first season with the groin injuries, but he has been a more than serviceable safety his next 2 years, getting us to this year. So I'll let you take it away from there, Dave.
All right, well, let's talk first about, I mean, I zoomed in, and I think I'm the only person that's done that. I have identified that he was tripped up by Chicolo. Now, to what degree, if you look at that thing in slow-mo, Chicolo does kind of step on his back foot, and then it looks like both of his feet kind of cross on the next step after that. So he was...
His right leg does not go in the angle that it would go if it was not touched. He takes a step across his left leg.
Right, and that's after Chicolo...
Yes.
Steps on that back thing, was the back left foot at the time. All right, so we've established, and then look, I mean, we don't even know the impact of the arm on the shoulder bit, but in my opinion, that, you know, let's not throw that out. Now, you can barely see, before it goes out of frame, him falling forward, and he kind of arms both arms out, okay, as he falls into the back of Alex Smith's legs. He doesn't appear to rap, though. Now, you know, could he control that? The angle, did he know that did he know the ball was away at that point? Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk is emphatic about he knew the ball was away, and regardless of the trip, he knew what he was doing in that situation, and that, yes, he needs to be fined. From the angles that we have, all I can say is that we can identify that he was tripped, and we can identify that both arms are kind of out at, I don't know, 3 yards distance spread as he's going down to the ground. I think it's hard to identify him knowing that the pass was away, but even so, Smith's backing up to him pretty quick, you know, after being tripped. So there is a lot of gray there, but there is truth to, in my opinion, it's right to confirm that Mitchell was tripped. And that backs up what Mitchell said and what Mike Tomlin said. So now we'll see if he's fined. The penalty was...
And Alex Smith, by the way, said he didn't say much after... Now, Alex Smith on the field was some kind of hot for sure. And he didn't say a lot, or he says he didn't say a lot in the post game. I wasn't really following those comments closely, but he told Adam Teicher, who we've had on the show, who we had on the show before the game, he said to him that it was clearly a dirty play. I mean, he believes after looking at the tape that it was fully intentional.
All right. And we'll see what the league says now. I mean, what he was rightly penalized, right? Mike Tomlin said as much. I mean, you got
in the speed of play, the optics, everything else. There's contact with the lower leg, absolutely, and yeah, he was rightly penalized.
All right, and if he's rightly penalized,
he will get fined.
He'll probably get fined
because you're not gonna. I mean, intent. You know, ideally, you're not legislating intent here, so intent should not really matter. He went into the legs of the quarterback, went low. His right arm's out. It makes contact. You know, look, there are people out there after Mike Mitchell for sure, and you know, you can point to other plays. I mean, people are putting them out. You know, other people put out some videos of plays that weren't called where Mike Mitchell. I mean, there's an ugly hit on Carlos Hyde that you can look at if you look at some of the GIFs out there. I mean, it's a nasty hit. Mike Mitchell goes low, and it looks like he's going right for his knee, and Carlos Hyde's knee really buckles in an uncomfortable way. It's surprising that he was able to get up from it. So, I mean, there are plays that look bad out there, and for most defensive players, if you play in the league long enough, if you're playing in the defensive backfield and your job is to be a hitter, and that's Mike Mitchell's job, is if you're going to come with force, you're going to hit guys in the wrong spot, whether they move at the last second or you target, you know, something that you shouldn't. You're going to find tape on just about every player where he does something that can be deemed dirty.
And Mitchell was not fined for that. Now, here's the thing. If it's a dirty hit, it should be fined. I mean, if it's an illegal hit, it should be fined. And he was not fined for that. So you're penalizing the guy. You're crucifying the guy and calling him, giving him, saying he's got a rap sheet just because he's a physical player, just because fans of other teams and media members of other teams view it as a quote-unquote questionable hit. These defensive backs have it worse than anybody, right? Because it's bang-bang. They have to lower their target.
They're flying to the ball. They're playing at speed. You know, guys playing around the line of scrimmage are playing physically, but you just don't have that. You don't get a five-step run and start. I mean, guys playing, you know, at the linebacker position and specifically in the defensive backfield, you get a chance to run it, guys.
And look, if that would have been an illegal hit on Carlos Hyde, it would have been fine. And it wasn't. Now, Mike Mitchell, as far as I can tell, has only been fined twice for illegal hits. One was on Tyler Eifert a few years ago. All right, right call, right. That was right. The other one, I guess rightfully so, happened a couple years ago against the Chargers. That was a game he pushed Antonio Gates down to the ground from behind. Okay? Do you remember that? I put that up last night on my Twitter feed if you want to scroll through that as well. It was an away from the football push in the back, aggravation, okay? Type situation, and he was fined for that. Those are the only two times I think outside of him being angry, you know, not hit related. I think he was fined one more time for a celebration or something like that on the field. But that's it. I mean, we're talking about a guy that's gotten fined two times, and now he has a rap sheet and should be suspended or definitely, as Alex Smith says, there's a history there. Is two times a history? I mean, and look, people say, well, Dave, you sure seem to be going the opposite here, you know, with Mike Mitchell more than any other player. If this was Vontaze Burfict right now, and was tripped, I think I would try to zoom into that as well too. To find out. I don't care if it was Cam Thomas and he was on the team right now. I would be looking to find the truth of this matter here. But does he deserve the under a microscope or whatever, you know, the rap sheet or being labeled a dirty player?
You know, I think it's borderline. I'm not going to give Mike Mitchell a pass. I mean, you know, whether he was fined on the Carlos Hyde hit or not, it looks bad. You know, it's not the NFL doesn't always get it right one way or the other. So, you know, I just gave an example on the Marvin Lewis play where Marvin Jones play that I didn't like the way he behaved, but I do think it was a clean hit. So I think you put all of it together, and there, you know, when a player's own fan base doesn't like some of the things he does, that's not typically a great sign. So, I mean, take it for what you want. It's just, as Matthew said, look, the perception's out there, and that perception's not going to change. It's impossible for a guy to get that perception to change. It'll never change. For any player, once they're perceived as being, whether they're good things or bad things, physical, dirty, whatever they are, once you have that perception, you can't undo it because you can't have – you know, you can go through a season or two seasons with doing nothing, but it'll stay with you. And then if something again happens, it will come up again. So he's going to wear that the rest of his career.
Production offsets all.
Sure. Yeah, production. Mike Mitchell makes 5 interceptions the second half of the season. He will be Steeler fans' darling.
Look at James Harrison. I mean, is James Harrison a dirty player, David?
You know, that's a great counterexample for a guy who was James Harrison.
Hey, you didn't expect me to bring boxing gloves to a gunfight, did you?
Yeah, listen, here's the thing about James Harrison, which is very interesting, because James Harrison only was a dirty player as the rules were changing. Everything he was doing was within the limit, and then he got penalized and fined, as a lot of players did, because they had to adjust their game. And I don't count that transition period in from 2009 to 2012, 2013, that transition period where they were changing the rules, kind of continually tinkering with the rules, I don't consider anything that went on in that period of time to be dirty player stuff. And that's when James was getting fined and penalized.
I think most of the issue and why Mike Mitchell is kind of the whipping boy right now. And look, William Gay overcame whipping boy status, but it was a different kind of whipping boy status, if you will. I think it, you know, nothing to do with hits and all like that. I think fans mostly are frustrated with the fact that Mike Mitchell is never going to be regarded as one of the league's top 10 free safeties, top 50, maybe not even top 15 free safeties in the league. He doesn't does good oftentimes doesn't show up in the stat sheet at all. You have to search for him on tape. Him doing his job sometimes is all that you can point to as being good with him, and those type of things aren't highlighted by us on a week-in, week-out basis, him being in the right position and all like that. So from him not showing up in the stat category, for one, usually when we're talking about Mike Mitchell on top of it, it's usually was, oh, he got trucked by Kyle Usack down near the goal line type of things. And then the other times we're talking about Mike Mitchell is when he makes a big hit and he gets up and he acts like it was a 5-yard loss.
And that happened with Fournette in that Jacksonville game, whether that was him firing up the defense or Fournette kind of egging him on or whatever, the optics are really bad. 12-yard gain, you know, and you're jumping up and down.
And then you go back, what was it, a couple years ago, you forced a fumble against, what was it, the Raiders.
And you didn't know it was a fumble.
Right, and the church's money's laying on the floor and you're not picking it up there. Because he is, he's flexed. I think all that rolled in together. Do I like Mike Mitchell doing that kind of stuff? No. I've always, let your hit and do the talking on the field. People see it. But on top of it, Mike Mitchell's an excitable guy. That kind of stuff fires him up. And should he quote unquote showboat like that? No. Will he stop? Probably not. But unless Mike Mitchell starts you know, getting an interception every other week here moving forward, or very, very cleanly separate a wide receiver from a football type situation. He's you're right. He's not going to overcome this perception. People will wanted him cut for quite a while. They're going to want him cut regardless of what happens after this season ends. And will it happen? It might. I mean, you get an older player up there in age making, you know, the average yearly salary that he's making now. It's always a possibility that happens. But I think you have to take your glasses off and look at the pieces of this. And I think he is a you put it best at the top of this. He is a serviceable safety, and you can win with him. And I don't think you can circle too many games losses that you can say he was the reason because of it.
Okay, good stuff. And I want to make sure on Friday we get a chance to go around the NFL a little bit, because there's so much going on in the league. Ezekiel Elliott kind of reinstated the injuries that have happened. Interesting article by Mary Kay Cabot, if you have a chance to read it, yesterday. Kind of really going at the Browns organization again, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't. So we'll get into all that. But it's Bengals week, and we got our buddy Paul Denner Jr. coming up. So that's next. Okay, welcome back, and it's Wednesday. As always, we have a guest join us, a beat writer covering the opposing team, the Steelers and the Bengals, going at it at Heinz Field, 4:25 kickoff. And we're pleased to be joined by Paul Denner Jr. You can follow Paul at his name, at PaulDehnerJr. Paul, as always, thanks for being with us on the Terrible Podcast.
Yeah, no problem. Great to be with you.
Paul, tell us, we went through the season preview, so we'll assume our listeners are kind of up to speed on what's going on with the Bengals. A slow start to the season. They fire the offensive coordinator. They make some changes in terms of what they're doing. And when I look at the situation right now, even though the Bengals are 2-3, I look at them as the competition for the Steelers to win this AFC North. How good of a team are the Bengals right now?
Yeah, you know, I think they have sort of survived the early season disaster, which they was very much in play for them after they went 0-2 without scoring a touchdown the first 2 weeks. It was chaos, and players were sort of calling out the coach, and it ended up being the offensive coordinator, Ken Zampezi, turned into sort of the sacrificial lamb. What's happened since is they've sort of looked like the team that they have been over the last half decade. Their offense showed, you know, some resiliency in bouncing back. I mean, they're averaging 25 points per game under Bill Lazor. Andy Dalton has a 116 rating under Bill Lazor. And they were atrocious, and Andy Dalton looked completely lost with Ken Zampezi at the helm. And so really, the last 3 weeks, I think, are more the team that they are, they're really going to be. And that was two wins and one, you know, inch away from beating Aaron Rodgers in Lambeau, and what ended up being an overtime loss where Rodgers needed to drive them and threw a touchdown pass to tie it with a couple of seconds left, and then had a long pass in overtime. So, that, you know, I think that they have turned a corner and look to be, I think, definitely the competition for the Steelers. I think if you look at the way the Ravens are trending and the Bengals are trending, and they're kind of going in opposite directions.
When you think about Lazor and what he's done coming in as the offensive coordinator, are there tangible things you can look at in terms of scheme, personnel, play calling that is different? Because, you know, Dalton's been around for a long time. I wasn't surprised they made a move, but I was surprised to see the results change so dramatically.
Yeah, it's funny. It's the first time in 50 years, this is their 50th season, first time in 50 years they fired a coordinator during the season. Never happened before. And there was a reason why. It was because no one was on board with what was happening. And the tangible things are the ball is getting out faster, because the Bengals have an offensive line issue. That's no secret. They're rotating tackles. They can't protect anything for the life of them. They're having trouble blocking for the run. So, but before that, they were still trying to do a drop back and throw it deep. And, you know, they have gone to really the quick passing game has sort of become their hammer at this point. A lot of quick throws, a lot of slants, a lot of stuff out to the running backs. They promoted Joe Mixon, essentially. He had sort of been an extra guy, but now he's become the primary back. And they've gotten a little bit of a spark from that, although their running game and his numbers running the ball don't show it. He has given them a lift in a lot of spots. And those are really the biggest things, that and hammering the ball into A.J. Green. And, you know, when your philosophy is, look, let's just throw it to A.J. Green a lot, it works out for you a lot of the time. And so they've kind of taken that on for right now. There's a lot of things they need to fix and steps they need to take to get better. I mentioned the running game. They need to hit a few more deep balls. They had one against Buffalo. But right now the biggest change is the quick passing game and trying to take the offensive line out of the game a little bit has been the biggest thing.
You know, Paul, when you talk about Joe Mixon, he has shown a few flashes in there, but obviously with the losses in the offensive line during the offseason, they've yet to find any really continuity there. And, in fact, I think Joe Mixon only has something like a 32 or 33% success rate on his run so far. Is that fixable at all with that personnel they have up front there right now? It just looks like that they live and die by trying to get themselves in as many third and shorter situations as possible.
Yeah, I don't know how fixable the run game is. I think they're going to keep trying stuff, but at a certain point, you know, the run game is what it is for a reason. You got to be able to just block a guy. And too often, if you look, you know, if you get into Pro Football Focus stats, Joe Mixon has the fewest yards before contact of anybody in the NFL. He's just constantly having to make moves or getting hit in the backfield, 3, 4, 5 yards back, creating a lot of negative plays. I think the biggest thing they're trying to fix is try to get the negative plays out. I think they can live with only gaining a couple yards. They can't live with losing 3, 4, and 5, which was just happening far too often with guys just not holding blocks at all. So, you know, I think they're going to try to scheme their way around it for a little bit, try to figure out what they do best in the running game, but that was certainly, I'd expect some new wrinkles in there because A, it hasn't worked, and B, they've had a bye week to try to figure out how to make it work. So I think Pittsburgh will probably see some new things they haven't seen as far as the running game goes.
Funny you should say that about the negative yards, because I'm just working on a quick stat there. Their running backs this year, I think 19% of all carries have gone for 0 or negative yards. So interesting that you bring that up. When you look at A.J. Green, when you look at A.J. Green versus Joe Hayden this week, those two, I think, faced each other something like 7 times when Hayden was in Cleveland there. I think Green had 2 100-yard games and games that Hayden played in. What do you remember most about the Hayden versus A.J. Green matchups when those two would line up against each other?
I used to call Joe Hayden A.J. Green kryptonite because back in the earlier portions of both of their careers, nobody seemed to be better at holding A.J. Green down and frustrating a little bit than Joe Hayden when he was in Cleveland. It was just over and over again. As Hayden has gotten a little older in recent years with the Browns, A.J. has been winning most of those battles, and a lot of them Joe has missed because of injury and things like that. And I mean, their rivalry goes all the way back to their college rivalry between Florida and Georgia. They went at it a whole lot back then, and so they know each other super well. That's just it. I mean, Joe Hayden is not going to be surprised by anything he sees as far as a move that A.J. Green makes. It's always been a fun one to watch for me. From a Bengals standpoint, you know, I think there's encouragement that A.J. has been getting the best of that matchup in recent years.
Paul, looking at the offense, I mean, Tyler Eifert, such a disappointing kind of run here for him with injuries and now the season-ending back surgery. What's the level of drop-off from Eifert's play to Tyler Croft? I mean, I've seen Croft do some good things in some of the tape I've watched. How good a player is he?
I mean, he's not Tyler Eifert, and that's sort of the problem. I mean, Eifert brings you just a rare game-changing ability, particularly in the red zone, and Croft can make some plays, but he's not that. You can't run a one-on-one and know for sure that he's open or you could throw him open, which you could always do with Tyler Eifert. That's the biggest difference. I think the scheme going to the right direction, the scheme working a guy open, he can get open, but if you're in a one-on-one, you know, I don't know how many that you can assure that Tyler Cross is going to be able to win that all the time. I think that's where the drop-off is. But he has made some plays. He does seem to be growing into his zone a little bit and gaining some confidence in himself and the quarterback in him. So I think the Bengals are rolling with that a little bit right now. But, you know, it's crazy to think that someone would come in and be able to do some of the things that Tyler Eifert does. It's just it's not fair to Tyler Cross.
The Steelers offense is obviously dominated by the touches that Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell get. And it looks like the Bengals are kind of rolling that direction with Joe Mixon actually having more catches out of the backfield than Geo with 11 versus 10, although Geo's being more productive, and with A.J. Green. You know, if you're going to think about secondary guys, if you're Keith Butler, who are you worried about? And we're obviously not seeing any production out of Tyler Boyd or John Ross so far this season. What are their roles going to be?
Yeah, you know, I think the secondary guys I would be most concerned with would be Geo. You know, Bernard has, when he's gotten the ball, been very dangerous this year. And you could argue one of the biggest mistakes if you're picking that Bill Lazor has had is that he hasn't gotten him involved as much as you would like to see. They've really kind of very heavily gone to Mixon. Mixon, when put in the right spot, has been dangerous. I've been able to do things that, you know, Jeremy Hill hasn't been able to do, which is make a lot of guys miss and make up for some of that. So, I think the running backs out of the backfield is the biggest secondary weapon that I would be concerned about. I think the Steelers shouldn't have much of a problem covering everybody not named A.J. Green one-on-one and win a lot of those battles. The Bengals just haven't proven to be able to win those enough. You know, they've clearly gone to quick passing game to A.J. Green and trying to get these running backs out in the backfield. And you know, the Brandon LaFell's Boyd is now hurt, so Alex Erickson will be in there, an undrafted guy out of Wisconsin a year ago playing in the slot. John Ross may or may not play. He's on the fence right now trying to come back from his knee injury. He did return to practice this week, so we'll see. You know, I think he's probably a 50-50 shot. Either way, he's not only is he not really played, he's hardly even practiced with the team, so I think he's going to come in, make a major impact this fall. So I think, you know, if you're Butler, it's stop Green. Don't let them get these guys out of the backfield catching in space. And the rest of it, just win one-on-one because a lot of people have been doing that.
Even after the Bengals started 0-2, I kept telling our listeners, watch out for this defense. This defense is playing well. The offense has had their problems, but the defense should be able to help things out here. A guy like Carl Lawson, who all Steeler fans are familiar with because the Steelers heavily scouted him ahead of the draft and all. This guy looks like the real deal, and it's not overly surprising. But how are they using him specifically? And also, Andrew Billings seems to be getting about 10 or 12 snaps a game as well, too.
Yeah, Carl Lawson has been amazing. I'm going to tell you, he's one of the best rookies I've ever seen as far as making an impact immediately. And that's counting all rounds, not even figuring the fact that he's a fourth-round pick. They've been using him as a nickel pass rusher. And, you know, so anytime they're out there at a nickel, which is, you know, these days anymore, about 70% of the snaps, he's out there on the edge, and they bump Michael Johnson into the middle. Now, what that's done is Michael Johnson was really struggling off the edge in recent years. He just didn't have the same bend. He didn't have the same burst that he had earlier in his career. And a lot of people before the season were wondering, is Michael Johnson even going to make this team? Well, what has happened is Michael Johnson has bumped inside and refound himself. He has really been tough inside, and he's worked really well with Geno Atkins. So you've improved your interior nickel pass rush. And Carl Lawson, you know, I ran a ton of numbers on what he's done the first few weeks. He has been the best rookie edge rusher that we have seen thus far in the last 6 years. That tops Joey. He's been better than Joey Bosa was last year. He's been better than you name it. He's just consistently getting back to the quarterback around the edge, and he's got speed to power moves that the Bengals just haven't had. The knock on him was his injury history and being a little undersized, but the undersized thing has not shown up a lick. He has just been an absolute beast around the edge, and it's really changed everything for what they're able to do with their pass rush. Suddenly their pass rush looks a lot like what it used to look like back in the last few years with Mike Zimmer, when you had Geno Atkins and Carlos Dunlap were the young kids coming up and dominating along with Michael Johnson. It's really changed the game for them, and you add that into a lot of young players that have played it maybe better than I think you could have anticipated You're talking about William Jackson III, their first-round pick last year, who had a pick six of Aaron Rodgers. You're talking about Nick Vigil, who's their third-round pick in 2016. He has stepped in and really played incredibly well in his first season as a starter, better than they could have anticipated. And you took that, but Vontaze Burfict back next to him. This defense really looks like it could be something special, not just this year, but for a long time going forward, because the young pieces have meshed with some of the current residing Pro Bowlers, and very much the same way the Steelers have found this rejuvenated youth movement pushing their defense to the next level, the Bengals look very much the same, very similar that way.
Is it best for this Steelers offense to just try to pound that run? It seems like the Bengals are kind of hit and miss sometimes, a little spotty occasionally against the run. Is that the game plan the Steelers should have, more of what they've done this past week against KC and a few weeks ago against Baltimore?
Probably. I mean, these games are, I think if the Steelers don't turn it over and give this offense, this Bengals offense, short fields, I think you certainly would be favoring Pittsburgh here. So, that's the best way to keep from the turnovers happening. And you're right. I mean, the number one hammer of the defense has been their pass rush, particularly in third and long situations. So, the more the Steelers are out there just running the ball, I think the more they're not feeding into the number one thing that the Bengals do. And the Bengals are fine against the run, but Le'Veon Bell's had some days against this team, so it's wouldn't be crazy at all to imagine him going and repeating some of the stuff we saw last week against Kansas City against this Bengals team. So yeah, that's probably the best method, but you never know what's going to happen or how the game's going to twist.
Paul, one of the things we've seen is Ben's had some trouble against this defense playing largely kind of cover two with the safeties back, playing relatively deep. Is that what they've been playing this year? And do you expect to see more of the same in terms of the looks with the success they've had with against Ben?
Yeah, I mean, the Bengals are not going to – the one thing that they're not going to try to do is they're not out there trying to get exotic and outsmart people with their regular stuff. I mean, some of their third down blitzes and coverages are going to shake it up and try to get disguised things. But for the most part, defensive coordinator Paul Gunther likes to keep it simple type of deal. Just make sure everybody knows exactly what they're doing, avoid missed assignments, and go make the plays. And that involves dropping back and keeping everything in front of them. They lead the league in fewest amount of explosive plays against. They're going to force you to drive the field little by little and hope that you mess it up. Gunther likes the line, more games are lost than won in the NFL. He tries to allow the other team to lose games rather than go trying to get crazy and win them. And that's going to – I don't think their philosophy is going to change at all.
And then I'll just wrap you up with Vontaze Burfict. Obviously, Steeler fans are paying attention to him. Mike got asked about him yesterday in his press conference. Is he still the – do you look at him as kind of the playmaker leader of that defense, or so at least in the middle of that defense?
Yeah, he's – I mean, look, everybody has their opinion on Burfict and what he is. As far as the extracurricular stuff and whatever, and that's all we can talk about that till we're long in the tooth. As a player, I can tell you I've never seen him better than he looked this camp and in the Buffalo game. I mean, he looked like an all-pro type of player. He's just everywhere, making plays sideline to sideline, tackles for loss, solo tackles, passes defense. He just really kind of does everything. And this team, this defense really does feed off of the edge that he plays with. Very much, very Steelers-like in that way. And in the way Steelers teams feed off the edge that they play with and the physicality. And I think, a lot of people don't like Burfict, but as far as the Bengals going into a hostile environment, I think a guy being there like that sort of helps them play with the swagger that they do, and I think that they do need him. They need him to not lose his mind in key spots, but I mean, that's gonna always the thing that you're sort of playing with Burfict. But as a football player and out there keeping you in games, I mean, he looks as good as he's ever been in his career right now.
So why don't you just wrap us up with what the Bengals let's assume the turnover situation doesn't determine the game. What do the Bengals need to do to win?
You know, they've got to stop Le'Veon Bell. I think they've come up with a pretty decent strategy and been effective containing Antonio Brown to where, you know, I think they feel like they can stick with that and know what they're doing there. But Bell has had games against them, and I think his style frustrates them a little bit. And they have to keep that so they are getting them into that those third and long situations. I think where it flips into the Bengals' hands, where they're bringing these pass rushers, trying to get them throwing the ball into places that he shouldn't under pressure. And that's what they're going to have to do. But they can't do that if they're constantly fighting third and two, third and three, third and one all day. They've got to keep those yards limited by Bell, get the Steelers in third and long, and let this defensive pass rush do what it's been doing all year and try to get them into some bad decisions.
How about a prediction for us real quick, Paul?
I think the Steelers will win. I am really more intrigued by what the second game looks like this year. I feel like this Bengals team needs a little bit more time to mature to win a game like this. They've got a lot of guys playing that have never played the Steelers with meaningful snaps before. And I think that will probably be the difference in at least a play or two. I think the Steelers have a little more season than being at home. But it's going to be one of those. Just we've seen this game a million times, right? 17-12, something like that.
Yeah,
the Steelers can find a way to win.
Hey, Paul, always appreciate your time, man. Great insights. Enjoy the game this weekend, and we'll catch up with you later in the season.
Sounds great. Have a good one, guys.
Okay, Dave, good stuff from Paul. He always gives us, straight up insights on what's going on with the Bengals. And as you've talked about this Bengals D, it's interesting to hear what he was saying. They do look like maybe they're not going to have to do a tear down and rebuild. And I do like the comparison of what the Steelers are doing. William Jackson is a guy they didn't have at all last year as their first round corner, obviously taken right in front of Artie Burns. So we'll see how all this plays out. This should be a fun game. And I certainly don't think it's a layup. I am fully of the belief, having seen the Ravens play and seen the Bengals play enough this year, that they are the contender to the Steelers in the AFC North. And a Steeler win in this game certainly doesn't wrap up the division, but it gives them a fair bit of leeway as they go to the Lions and then the bye for the second half of the season, having beaten all three teams in the division and being ahead of them as well.
Yeah, you know how important it is to win those division games. And look, this one, remember the Reds and the Pirates back in the late 70s and early 80s? Whoever had the last at bat sometimes, who's going to have the ball last in this game? I'm with them. I think the more I watch this Bengals defense play, I think this could be one of those 16-13, 17-12 games type of deals. And, boy, don't turn the football over in this game. But I've watched a little bit of that Bengals-Bills game already, starting to roll through the tape. I'll have more time by Friday so you and I can thoroughly discuss the Bengals-Steelers game coming up on Sunday there. So we'll have plenty of time to discuss that. We'll go over what the injury report's shaping up to be and any other news that might hit between now and then. In the meantime, folks can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. They can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. You can hear the show, or you can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and you want to donate to the cause, please go to SteelersDepot.com, hit the donate button up right navigational bar, and David will sleep fast. Friday will be here before you know it.
Yeah, and the latest odds, Super Bowl odds came out. The top three teams in the AFC, the Pats 4-1, Steelers 7-1, Chiefs 7.5-1, and then the next seven teams are from the NFC. So not surprising, but an interesting way to look at things as we're kind of past the one-third mark of the season. And as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.